Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly digest of crime and mystery fiction. To give you a sense of what the magazine is about, we offer these podcasts of stories from our back issues. In this installment, we bring you The God of Right and Wrong by Stephen Gore from our January-February 2010 issue. This story was shortlisted for a Seamus Award in 2011 by the Private Eye Writers of America. Stephen Gore is a San Francisco-based private investigator turned novelist. His fifth book, the private eye thriller A Criminal Defense, came out in 2013 from HarperCollins. The story, The God of Right and Wrong, is being read by the author's friend, Seth Norman.
Would have been better if he died before he got so ridiculous. The whispered words emerged out of a dying gust of wind, spoken by a young man standing behind me at the gravesite. They were followed by the stifled laughter of another, and then a sarcastic, "Down these mean streets a man must go, who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid." Jesus Christ, did Chubb have to quote Raymond Chandler every time he left the office? Another laugh, this one anticipatory. "And that hairball sports jacket. You look like roadkill." I glanced over my shoulder, catching the eye of the first speaker, then the second. They both reddened and lowered their gazes. The wind gusted again. I watched a swirl of dead leaves rise from the grass and come to rest around the minister's feet. I knew a religious man would have found symbolism in it, a final gesture by nature, a returning of dust to dust. But I didn't. I figure we're no different than squirrels in winter. The only meanings we uncover, the only meanings we can uncover, in the coincidences of the present are ones we've buried in the past. I looked down at Robert Chubbin's casket suspended over the grave. At least the two men standing behind me could give a reason for attending the funeral, though I suspected it would only be partly true. I didn't even have that to explain why I'd driven the 300 miles down the coast from San Francisco, and I doubted the others semi-circled around the gravesite could have given honest reasons either. They'd all suffered a small death when they retired from their jobs as police officers or attorneys, and now felt alive only in the retelling of war stories. For them, Chubb's passing away was nothing more than a chance for rebirth. I gazed over the casket toward the low clouds that had crawled in from the ocean and reached over the cliff. They'd now surrounded the downtown office buildings and submerged the courthouse dome, under whose cover those around me had found meaning in their lives. A cresting wave of fog was sweeping up the hill beneath our feet, filling the spaces between the headstones and dissolving the crescent-shaped city below. Judge Malcolm MacDonald shivered next to me. For 40 years, he'd been the centripetal force that controlled the county. His word was law, and his will unalloyed by doubt, by indecision, or by trembling hands. He shivered again, and the overhanging shoulder of his ancient suit brushed against my arm, his arthritic body unable to steady itself. When I reached over to support him, my hand met loose cloth draped over wasted muscle and bone, his body seeming like an eroded granite statue sheathed by dry moss. The judge glanced up from under his thick eyebrows, but neither thanked me nor apologized. "Can we talk afterwards?" he asked. I nodded and looked back at the minister, now closing his Bible against the mist that had drifted in. He then concluded the formalities with the same hollowness with which he'd begun them, and with an embarrassed silence, for he'd twice misspoken the name of the deceased. Chubbins had come out once as Chibbins, and later as Chibans, and no one had intervened to correct him. The minister turned away and started for his car. There was no reason for him to remain among the mourners, for Chubb had neither a wife nor children to comfort, nor parents to console about a reversed course of life. When we reached the sidewalk at the bottom of the slope, the judge pointed at the passenger side of his Lincoln. I helped him into the driver's seat, then walked around to the other side and climbed in. "Chubb made me the executor of his estate without telling me," the judge said. "Why you?" I knew the answer, but had asked anyway, wondering whether the judge would acknowledge the truth. The real reason was that Chubb's father had died rescuing McDonald during the Korean War, and the debt had been passed on to the son like an inheritance. But that wasn't how the judge answered, for he would never want to be seen as a man who needed saving. Even though we were a generation apart, Chubb thought that I understood him because we both had lousy marriages. But he never grasped that we were unhappy in different ways. His love for his wife was twisted. Mine was non-existent. He crossed himself. May she rest in peace. Because I'd never met Chubb's wife, there'd always been an unreality about his early days. A serial murderer had killed Belle 20 years earlier, when I was still in high school, and before I decided to become a private investigator. She'd been the day shift dispatcher for the police department. That was where they'd met in the 1980s, when Chubb was a 30-year-old patrol officer, floundering in his unfulfilled aspiration to be promoted to detective. Why Chubb married her, I'll never understand, the judge said. She always came at him like a cue ball, hard and spinning on the axis of her malice. In his phrasing, I heard an echo of his trademark use of billiard analogies from the bench. Shall we rack him up and get this trial underway? I think you snookered yourself, counsel. Scratch. Objection overruled. Sometimes she'd come at him low, he continued now, pop him and then pull back. Other times with topspin and keep pounding him and pounding him. The bitterness of her memory displayed itself in the judge's twisted mouth. He noticed that I noticed and said, as you get older, it gets harder to conceal your emotions. She was an intolerable person, and the least missed of all the poor souls killed by that maniac. The two men who'd been standing behind us at the service walk passed on either side of the judge's car and got into an SUV parked three spaces ahead. You know who those smart guys are? I asked. From hunger. Hand-to-mouth PIs Chubb fed work to. They'll be out of the business soon enough and back to stacking shelves at the Ace Hardware. The judge fell silent as we watched them drive away, and then said, they were right, though. He'd gotten ridiculous. Cartoonish. I owed Chubb for giving me my start in the business, so I didn't join in the derision. But I knew what the judge meant. Something sweet can be rendered so long it gags you, and Chubb had gotten sickeningly earnest and moralistic over the years, like an ever-smiling priest struggling to disguise his unrelenting consciousness of temptation and sin. Instead, I asked, why'd you want to talk to me? The judge stared ahead for a moment as though he was coloring in his final image of Chubb, and then said, I wonder if you wouldn't mind going through his office and apartment, find out what he was working on, and hand out the cases to anyone who wants them. He uttered the words in a way that suggested it didn't make a difference who handled them, as though the fates of Chubb's clients had already been ordained. He then gestured toward the gravesite. See if there's anything we can sell to pay for this. I'm out $5,000. I offered to split it with him. Take a look at what he's got before you decide to do that. He reached into his pocket and handed me Chubb's keys. Make up a list of what there is to sell. The probate judge will approve it if you sign off. It's Ed Jennings. He's still disappointed you didn't marry his daughter and take her with you. McDonald smiled like a conspirator. He was counting on you to make his heart grow fonder. Driving away, I realized that walking up to Chubb's gravesite had led me into an obligation I could only fulfill by pawing through the relics of his life in the half-shadow of his death. And I got an anxious feeling that in fulfilling it, I was going to do things I didn't want to do, see things I didn't want to see, and learn things I didn't want to learn. But the truth is that we all do go home again, if only to discover why we'd fled. The furniture in Chubb's office was laid out the same as it was when I quit 10 years earlier. My old desk in the outer room was bare, as if it had retired at the same time I left town and went out on my own. I figured it might be worth $50 to a college kid, and I recorded the item on a notepad I found in a drawer. The three file cabinets, maybe 25 each. They were lockable, but the keys had been misplaced long before Chubb hired me. The framed news clippings tacked to the walls, yellow remnants of Chubb's big cases, were only worth the price of a memory. Chubb's inner door was closed. I heard a rustling from inside and a metallic clicking, like someone had pulled out a file cabinet drawer. I flashed on the faces of the two young men at the funeral and wondered whether they'd decided to also pay their respects to Chubb's office. But I dismissed the thought. They'd have hit the place the day Chubb's heart failed him, not waited a week. I guessed it was probably an obituary-reading burglar come to empty the place on a day when he believed no one would be around. I waited for more rustling to cover the sound, then eased the door open a few inches. Across the room, Venetian blinds snapped in the wind, rain splashing against the slats and spattering Chubb's desk and blotter. I pushed the door against the breeze now surging into the office and made a path through the maniacal hopscotch pattern formed by the papers that had been blown onto the floor. As I closed the double-hung window, I could see lights on upstairs in the bank across the street, the bodies of the workers inside appearing rippled and twisted through the downpour sheathing the glass. An acrid odor rose from the damp wooden seat. A furnace-like rage built inside me when I realized what it was. Staring down at it, I wasn't sure what angered me more, that Chubb had been discovered sitting in urine released by his bladder as he died, or that no one had bothered to clean it up. In my hurt and anger, I felt like a proxy for the humiliation from which death had insulated him. I retrieved a rag and a bottle of cleaning fluid from the utility closet in the hallway and began scrubbing it away. A knock on the outside door broke through the slop of the rag on wood. It was followed by a quick back-and-forth snap of metal on metal of the twisting doorknob. I dried my hands as I walked over to open it. It was the two men from the funeral. The short one stood facing the door. The taller was angled off, eyes watching the elevator at the end of the hallway as though he was a lookout. They were still dressed in suits. Both carried backpacks. "You guys need something?" I asked. The taller one turned toward me, while the shorter one shrugged and said, "We thought maybe you could use some help." He was quicker with a lie than I had anticipated. "Doing what?" "You being Chubb's great success, and us seeing you with old Judge McDonald, we figured you were cleaning things up." He looked past me toward the inner office as though he was standing at the end of the line at the Salvation Army on Thanksgiving Day, not wondering what they were serving, but whether there'd be any turkey left by the time he arrived at the front. I stepped aside to let them enter, only because I wanted to learn what they were after. They walked straight through the outer office and into Chubb's. From behind, I watched their heads move and stop, jerky but targeted. Oil painting, file cabinet, desktop, oil painting, stack box, bookshelves, oil painting. The short one stared at the painting as if he were having a Superman fantasy that he could see into the safe concealed behind it. "What did Chubb have you guys working on?" They turned toward me. "Serving summonses and subpoenas and cases, stuff like that," the taller one said. He pointed at files standing in a wire rack on Chubb's desk. "Those are probably them." I walked over, wrote down the clients' names and the names of their attorneys, and handed the stack to him. He cradled them under his arm instead of placing them into his backpack. Gesturing toward the wall to my left, I asked, "How about you guys helping me move that desk over there? I want to use the middle of the room to organize things." They nodded and set down their packs. Even though they tried to do it gently, I heard thunks as the bottoms touched the wooden floor. It was the confession I had expected to hear. Concealed inside were tools they brought to pry the safe out of the wall. They pretended they hadn't confessed, and I pretended I hadn't heard of them. We pushed the desk, but it held firm, gripped by depressions in the damp oak floor formed over 30 years by its metal feet. We lifted and moved it in one motion, but then the leg at my end caught. I glanced underneath and saw it was jammed against a water-warped plank. This hadn't been the first time the window had been left open during a rainstorm. I raised the corner of the desk and we slid it the rest of the way. "Why don't you do the same thing out there?" I said, pointing toward the outer office. I rolled up Chubb's damp blotter and jammed it into the trash can, then pulled out his middle drawer and emptied it onto the desk. Taped to the back was the combination to the safe. I figured the two guys were burglars, but not killers, so I risked opening it. Turned out there was nothing inside worth killing for anyway. Just news clippings about his wife's murder and a bottle of 18-year-old scotch that was now 6 years older, based on the date on the note addressed to me, along with the words, "From a tarnished and fearful man, please remember me the way I had hoped to be. Chubb." He'd rightly assumed that after his heart disease finally killed him, Judge McDonald would shift part of his executor's burden onto me and ask me to attend to his earthly afterlife. I wondered why he hadn't asked me himself. Four expectant eyes were looking past me when I turned around. I pointed at their packs. "You guys went to a lot of trouble for nothing." The taller one pretended he misunderstood what I meant and said, "It wasn't no trouble. We were glad to help out." He looked at his pal, asking him to join him in the lie. "Weren't we?" After they left, I drove to a hotel cupped along the cliff above the harbor. I heard the surf chewing at the beach below as I walked across the parking lot toward my room after I checked in. I left the scotch on the dresser and took the news articles I'd found in the safe into the coffee shop, where I ordered a hamburger to make up for my missed lunch. After reading the first story, published the morning after Chubb found Belle's body laying on their kitchen floor, I was overcome with a feeling of childish voyeurism. As in every other notorious case, I knew the succeeding articles would be less about the victims and more about the anguish of their surviving families. Chubb himself had never talked about those days, except to say he was embarrassed to have been seen as so pitiful. I set them aside and turned on my cell phone. It had been off since the start of Chubb's funeral. There were a dozen messages, the last five from my secretary. She called again as the waitress walked up with my order. "You on your way back?" The judge asked me to help clean up Chubb's estate. I didn't need to explain to Helene who the judge was. She was the mother of a girlfriend of mine from high school. She'd gone to church with Chubb and got divorced in McDonald's court. After her daughter and I broke up, Helene and I stayed friends, and about the time I sprung free of the town's gravitational pull, she told me she needed to escape what felt to her like an already lived life and asked to come with me. "Clean up his estate?" Helene said. "Chubb didn't have anything you can call an estate. Legally speaking, it's everything that wasn't buried with him. Does that include Belle?" She laughed. "I'll bet she's been saving up all her barbs for 20 years, just waiting for him to land next to her so she could start sticking them in." I was no more willing to join in disparaging Belle than I was Chubb, and I suspected that none of those people who did had ever tried to imagine Belle's terror when Neil Smelzer, the serial killer, made her the last of his victims. That was the reason why Helene always said it was better I handled white-collar cases instead of street crimes. I always took in too much of the world by looking out through other people's eyes. I changed the subject back to what it was supposed to be. I got a bunch of calls from the lawyers for China Pacific Industries. "They need your testimony after all," Helene said. "The witness from Beijing went sideways, and they want you in on Monday to set things straight for the jury." "Have them push it until Tuesday. I need to meet with McDonald and the probate judge." After I disconnected, I noticed that the only thing lingering from the conversation was the name of Belle's murderer. Every region of the country had one like him. The Trailside Killer. The Zodiac. Jeffrey Dahmer. For a decade after Smelzer was convicted, gallows humor around the police department demanded that victims shot in the face be referred to as having been Smelzered. And a Smelzer deal became shorthand among the defense bar to describe defendants who deserved the death penalty but received life without parole. The combined name, Smelzer Dahmer, the Jeffrey who had also escaped execution, became the code phrase for everything that was wrong with the criminal justice system. I thumbed through the articles as I ate. When I spotted McDonald's picture, it made me remember another bit of a local shorthand. It was called Pleading Open to Mac. In the course of a generation, McDonald had become like the god of a civic religion, the one onto whom the community had shifted the burden of resolving the moral dialectic of hard cases. Adult crimes committed by confused children, calculated murder by abused and desperate women, rash acts by otherwise temperate men. And in these wrenching clashes, the defendant would agree to plead guilty and leave his fate entirely up to McDonald. Sometimes the judge would make the punishment fit the crime. Other times, he'd make the crime fit the punishment. In his hands, a robbery would be renamed a grand theft, or an assault with a deadly weapon would be renamed a battery, or a murder would be renamed a manslaughter if it served in his mind to synthesize the opposing demands of law and justice. His clerk sometimes referred to her docket as the Book of Genesis, for his naming so often seemed to be an act of creation. The open pleas were prized by prosecutors and lower court judges because MacDonald would take the heat for low sentences in notorious but weak cases. Also by defense attorneys because it relieved them of the burden of defending the indefensible. And by defendants because MacDonald seemed to be the just and merciful father none of them ever had. And finally by the public because a hammering gavel seemed to sound like a coffin being nailed shut. I once heard someone explain British voters throwing Winston Churchill out of office after World War II by saying that all politics is local. The analogy I discovered watching MacDonald over the years was that all justice is personal. And that's exactly what pleading open to Mac meant. No one in the city would admit that truth, for they all publicly embraced the founding myth that we're a nation of laws and not of men. But all of them secretly feared that if they didn't interlink their arms around it, the centrifugal forces of disorder would destroy their world. The articles also reminded me of how the Smeltzer case ended. An illegal police search of Smeltzer's apartment had led to one of those volatile moments. It resulted not only in the discovery of the unusual 4.55 caliber bullets that tied Smeltzer to the murders, but also in a tainted confession Judge MacDonald later threatened to suppress. Fearing MacDonald might actually do it, the prosecutor passed on seeking the death penalty and offered Smeltzer life without parole. Fearing he might not, the defense grabbed the deal. Leafing through the stories, I remembered my impression of Chubb as I had watched him on television after Smeltzer had been sentenced, speaking on behalf of all the victims' families, humble and heroic. Especially as he quoted MacDonald, who'd said from the bench, "Hard cases make bad law, and this court will not make bad law." And Chubb, forgiving the detective who'd fractured the case by breaking into Smeltzer's apartment before the search warrant had been issued. It was the Smeltzer case that set me on the road to becoming a private investigator, not because I thought capital punishment was a good thing, but because it struck me that there ought to be a way for people to find out the truth, the whole truth. Even those parts filtered out by an evidentiary prism that too often refracted the most important facts to the invisible part of the legal spectrum. Even though I was only a senior in high school, I sought Chubb out. He let me work in the office until I was 18, then sent me out to serve subpoenas. He started me doing witness interviews during my junior year in college and took me on full time when I graduated. His graduation present to me was a copy of Raymond Chandler's The Simple Art of Murder, from which Chubb adopted the melodramatic phrase about mean streets and unafraid men that had launched him into the world each morning. I never read it, for fiction wasn't the prism I wanted to use either. I preferred white light, unfiltered and unbent. After finishing my meal, I went back to my room and changed out of my suit. I decided to take it upon myself to clean up Chubb's office, maybe as a way of purging the past. So I stopped by a hardware store to buy a tool set, at an office supply store to buy banker's boxes. It took me the rest of the afternoon and evening to bare the walls and empty the file cabinets, drawers, and bookcases. By then the rain had stopped and night had fallen. I rolled my old chair from the outer office into Chubb's, and then turned off the lights and leaned back to rest. I noticed an older woman working upstairs in the bank building. Her blue dress and pale skin fluoresced under the harsh lighting as she rose from her desk and approached the window. When she stopped and stared toward Chubb's dark office, I recognized her as the woman Helene had once pointed out to me as Chubb's last girlfriend before he married Belle. The woman's eyes then went vacant, the way they do when the past drops a partition against the present. A few moments later, she wiped her eyes with the back of her sleeve, then turned away. A minute after that, the lights went out. I decided to intercept her as she left the building to give her a chance to share her burden of memories. The roller caught on the warped floor plank as I pushed back the chair. I felt a rush of misplaced anger. Although I knew it was just sublimated grief now rising to the surface, it spread like blood from a head wound and made me want to punish something. I flicked on the light, grabbed the toolkit and a bag of nails, and kneeled down to hammer the plank flat. But there was something odd about the piece of wood. The chaos of emotions within me withdrew into the background as I inspected the warped board. I pried it up with a screwdriver. A locked metal box was concealed underneath. It slipped from my fingers as I tried to pull it out. First, I blamed the sweat on my hand. Then I discovered it was nailed to the floor joists. I didn't want to waste time searching for a key, so I punched the lock. Inside, I found two antique bowie knives and three antique revolvers. A Uhlinger, a Star, and a Webley. All loaded and in mint condition. I wondered whether in them alone I had found enough value so that Chubb could pay for his own funeral. I called Elaine at her home, read off the makes and model numbers, and asked her to check on the web to find out how much I could get for them. She called back a few minutes later. About 12,000 altogether. She then laughed and said, "Gives new meaning to stashing something away for your old age." I then let MacDonald know I'd be dropping by his house with the knives and guns. I didn't trust leaving them in Chubb's safe and had nowhere else to store them. He sounded relieved that neither one of us would have to bear the final costs. The drive up the long hill toward his house took me back to my youth, when I delivered newspapers on my bike. None of the other kids wanted the route because it demanded a hard ride to make a single delivery. The judge had showed me he appreciated the effort by tipping me 50 cents every Sunday. MacDonald was sitting at his desk when I arrived. As I stepped inside his study, I remembered the first time I'd walked into the high-ceilinged room. Despite its enormity, it had seemed to enlarge his stature, and this was long before I understood either the alchemy of power in the city or the mysterious transubstantiation of a man into judge. But I'd changed since then, and my world had gotten larger, and now the room seemed to dwarf him like he was a penitent in St. Peter's. I set down the knives and guns along with Chubb's bottle of scotch on the desk in front of him. He collected two highball glasses from the bar. I poured and we toasted Chubb. After sitting down, MacDonald pointed at the buoys. "I sold him these about 10 years ago," the judge said. "I never liked knives." He then picked up the Star, turned it over in his hand, and set it down and reached for the Uhlinger. "I know this model," MacDonald said. "I had an uncle in Iowa who was a collector. I've been told it's worth about $7,000 alone." He set down the Uhlinger and picked up the Webley. "Interesting thing about the MKV one, MacDonald said, looking up at me. "Did you ever see the movie Zulu with Stanley Barker and Michael Caine?" I shook my head. "It was supposed to cover events that happened in 1879, but the Webley model the actors used in the film wasn't manufactured until 1917. The thought of it would turn my uncle livid, purple with rage." MacDonald gave me a blank look. "So we tried not to let him think about it." Instead of diluting his last sentence of meaning, his expression concentrated it. I thought about what he'd said earlier about age and emotion. "Another interesting thing is that Sherlock Holmes used a Webley MK. Given his literary bent, I guess it would be in the tradition for Chubb to own one too." I left him with the guns and his speculations and drove back to the hotel. I read the rest of the news articles before trying to fall asleep. It turned out to be more like a half-sleep, my mind trying to put together pieces of the puzzle from memory, each one shifting its shape as it drew my focus. I skipped breakfast the next day and drove to the courthouse. It took the criminal clerk about an hour to locate the Smelzer file in the storage room. Consumed most of the day to read through it, and I didn't like what I found. Then to the police department across the street. I told the records clerk I was working on something for Judge MacDonald. It didn't take her long to find the dispatch record I wanted. I didn't like what I found there either. I made a stop in town, then drove to the judge's house where I found him in his study. Lined up on the desktop in front of him were the .455 caliber bullets that had been chambered in the Webley. "Where's the gun?" I asked him. Judge MacDonald gazed up at me, his face bearing the same blank expression as last time. moment I saw it, he said, I knew you'd try to build a story around it. It's not a story. I felt rage once again building inside me. It's the truth. I read the court file. Smeltzer claimed he had an alibi for the night Bell was killed. No one even took a first step in checking it out because he'd already confessed to the other four murders, and the slugs from all five killings matched. I let that settle in him for a moment, and then said, I looked at the dispatch log for the afternoon before Bell was murdered. It showed an incoming call from a kid who found a gun. I talked to him today. The dispatcher told him to put it back where he found it, and that someone would be over to retrieve it. So? Bell worked the day shift, but it wasn't a woman who answered the dispatch line. It was a man. I watched the judge's jaw clench, but his eyes held still. I pointed my forefinger between them. And you made sure there'd be no trial, so no one would ever find out that Chubb used that gun to murder his own wife. The judge smirked. You expect people to believe that Chubb just happened to be in the police department, just happened to be in the dispatch center, just happened to pick up the phone when Bell was away from her desk? How would you know that? He pushed on as if he hadn't heard me. And the call just happened to be about a random gun that just happened to be the one Smeltzer used to kill all those people? That would be like breaking the rack and having all the balls roll into the pockets and leaving the cue ball in the center of the table. Coincidences don't happen like that in real life. I shook my head. The only thing that makes it look like a coincidence is that Chubb killed her with that particular gun. He would have grabbed any gun as long as he had no connection to it beforehand. McDonald didn't respond. He sat in silence for a few moments, then glanced at the bottle of the scotch on the bar. Finally, he took in a long breath and exhaled as though in resignation. That's not the reason Chubb went after that gun. When the kid said it was a .455 Webley, about as rare a caliber as there can be, Chubb guessed it was the serial killer's gun. He snatched it so he could play the hero and shame the department for not promoting him to detective. But then he decided to kill Bell with it and let the blame fall on Smeltzer. The judge dismissed the accusation with a wave of his hand. Bell found the gun in Chubb's glove compartment. She guessed what it was, too. She started dancing around with it, taunting him as a failed wannabe. They fought over it and went off. You mean, that's what Chubb said happened? What he said matched the evidence. McDonald's voice turned hard, and I wasn't willing to see Chubb's life go to ruin because of that bitch. The public had a right to decide that for themselves. The judge pounded the desk. Screw the public. If I say something is rape, it's rape. And if I say it's murder, it's murder. If you decided Chubb wasn't guilty, then he wasn't guilty. He gazed at me as if he was a teacher disappointed in a slow-witted student. Justice in this town is done inside my head, and that's where everyone wants it done. They prostrate themselves before me because they need someone to define the truth for them and bear the burden of sin, of error. McDonald rose and walked to the window behind him. He gazed at the city below as if he was the Pope looking down at the faithful. If these people come to doubt the Smeltzer verdict, they'll doubt them all. He glanced back at me, and they couldn't handle it. You haven't answered my question. Where's the gun? He gestured toward the ocean stretching from the rocky shore toward the last flare of sunset dying at the edge of the earth. I didn't believe him. But driving down the hill later, I found that I did believe him about something else. My exposing the truth about Chubb would transform the centripetal forces that held the city together into centrifugal ones that would tear it apart. So, what? It wasn't my town anymore. But as I drove through the darkening city, I was drawn toward the bar where those who found meaning in their lives under the courthouse dome gathered each evening. I parked and walked in. I paused in the shadow just inside the door and inspected their faces. I then understood what McDonald saw as he looked down from the bench. They were like aging, caged parrots, cackling and mimicking and laughing and fearless in their captivity. MacDonald hadn't made himself the god of right and wrong. They had, and not in their own image. Gazing past them at my reflection in the grayed mirror hanging on the wall beyond the pool table, I also understood what the judge saw when he looked at me. Someone who would walk away. Who had walked away, rather than lift the cover off the cage. And he was right. I walked from shadow into darkness, got back into my car, and headed north.
That was Seth Norman reading The God of Right and Wrong by Stephen Gore from the January-February 2010 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Seth Norman is the author of Meanderings of a Fly Fisherman and The Fly Fisher's Guide to Crimes and Passion, and is a friend of Stephen Gore's. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are now available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Magster, Sony, and on Google Play for your Android. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.